You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by our producers Andre, Arno and Alex. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. First up, I speak to AUSA President Alan Shaker for our monthly chat. Then Amelia chats with Green Party co-leader James Shaw for their weekly interview. I also speak to Ahi Wehongi, National Coordinator of Gender Minorities Aotearoa, about Posey Parker entering Aotearoa to hold transphobic events. Alex speaks to Cleve Cameron from Big Street Bikers about avoiding congestion by embracing cycling. Andre speaks to Doug Wilson from the University of Auckland about wireless charging roads. And Arno then speaks to Dilla Kalantan from the University of Auckland about a smoking cessation project. And Richard Easter, an astrophysicist, about light pollution from Starlink and other satellites. He aha ofakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka oa e wariware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, anō he pakiheri roki roki maurunga, i te pai, tuku tuku o irangi poho, mi haere ki 95 BFM, ira kati kom. And you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website.
The Wire. I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
And now we're joined in the studio by AUSA President Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
Not too bad, thank you, Jess. It's great to be here again.
How's your last month been? So much going on with the Alfred's event and O Week. How did that all go?
Oh, it's been amazing, incredibly busy, but amazing. It's just so fantastic to see so many students back on campus. We haven't seen that in a couple of years, so it's been incredibly busy, and the AUSA teams work incredibly hard, but it's also been amazing to see as well.
Yeah, and one of the things that happened during O Week was your Safe Zones initiative with the Auckland Council. Can you tell us a bit about this and how those went?
So I think I spoke about this when I was on The Wire last time, and this was an initiative launched by AUSA in partnership with Auckland Council and Red Frogs. Exactly what it sounds like, a safe zone for students and many other people who are in town during the busyness of O Week. Overall, we think this was a massive success. Our numbers suggest that over the three nights, we had about 1,200 people attend these safe zones. And by far out of the 3 days, probably Saturday, 4th of March, looks like it was our busiest day. We had about 500 people come through to our safe zones. In terms of what people were coming for, majority of the care was for like food and rehydration, but also medical assistance was provided. And unfortunately, we did have a couple of people who needed to go to hospital. And luckily, the safe zones were there for them for that reason. In terms of our two locations, we felt that the Alan Melville Centre was really a student-focused. A lot of students went there. And while the K Road event or the K Road location was served as purpose, we personally felt like in our analysis that a lot of students were going to the Alan Melville Centre more than the K Road Centre.
Mm. Another topic I wanted to talk to you about today was the recent disruptions to Auckland Transport's network since the start of the uni semester. So how are students coping with travelling to and from campus?
Look, through my conversations with students, I think it's a big struggle at the moment. Obviously, with the rail networks being down and a lot of traffic on the roads, it's in some instances, preventing students from coming onto campus. And if we want that full campus experience, I think we collectively have to do more. Us as a student body, the university, Auckland Transport, we all got to work towards solutions. So I'm really pleased to share that the AUSA Student Council is behind this. So at the moment, we're sort of collectively with the other student leaders from across the university drafting an open letter that'll go to the university in the first instance and look for collaborative ways we can work around this. So some ideas we have, potentially reinstating early bird parking into OGGB to make that more affordable for students. But also another option is to have shuttles. Something similar and across the road at AUT, they do that very well, where they have shuttles for their students. This is something we'd like to advocate for at our university as well.
Mm. And I wanted to talk to you about some potential issues with UOA infrastructure, particularly Wi-Fi access, and how that's either enabling or not enabling students to study on campus. So can you tell me a bit more about this?
Yep, absolutely. Again, this is probably one of the biggest issues that have come to us in the last month or so. And I think there's been some communications from the university about it, but ultimately the reality is it's affecting teaching and learning for students. Students can't come onto campus to study because you can't get a reliable connection. You can't, trust the Wi-Fi to submit an assignment on time. And again, relating back to the previous problem, that means students aren't coming onto campus. So I know there's been comms and AUSA is certainly trying to advocate to the university to do more about it, because I think it needs to be fixed, and it needs to be fixed quite urgently as well.
Mm. And we've recently seen the centralisation of student services, so that means sort of any help from different faculties on degree planning, anything like that, enrolment, instead of people going to their separate faculties, that's all been centralised into one student hub, right? So can you tell us about how this has gone?
Yep, so from memory, I think the centralisation came about in 2021, late 2021, and going into this year was always going to be the real test as to how that went, because in the last couple of years, we haven't had students on campus, so you haven't had the issues that we're having now. Now that we have students on campus, there are queues, wait times of hours upon hours, and I think at the moment the student hub are under-resourced, and as a result, students are suffering. I remember in O week, certainly, there were students who were queuing up outside the library doors, waiting for up to 3 hours just to see someone. So look, that's another issue that's top of our mind at AUSA, and we're looking at ways we can address this, whether that's potentially some of their resources could go online and students can access it online in an online-friendly manner, or whether that's speaking to the Student Hubs team and making sure that they're resourced and well-equipped to serve students.
Yeah, so what would your advice be for students who maybe trying to get help but are experiencing those really lengthy wait times? Where should they go for support or to kind of report that to you?
I mean, obviously, we have had students come to us and report those problems to us. Unfortunately, in that space, we're obviously at AUSA, we're not there to give course advice and that sort of stuff. But what we do and what we always aim to do is direct students into the right place. So students are more than welcome to come to us and speak to us, and we can direct them to the right place. What I would recommend is finding the contact details and flicking off an email to the relevant person, whether that's the department head, whether that's someone in Student Hubs, finding the right person to speak to and emailing them directly. And again, like I say, if students are struggling in terms of who to contact or where their email is, that's what AUSA is there for. We're happy to direct students in that way as well.
Mm. Well, that was all the questions I had for you, Alan. Thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll see you next month.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll be back after this short break.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
Bertico Beats with Juliana Sion, Amanda Bovo and guests, with support from Bobby Brazuca.
And tomorrow,
Corey Gonzalez McCure and friends with Ponsonby's premier comedy night, followed by Dimpri Duo and Kirsty Sutherland.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Of course, it is within this.
Hey, do you have a pen?
What?
A pen. I forgot my laptop.
Look, you're going to have to speak up. What was it?
Nothing, don't worry.
Would you be quiet?
What? Honestly, so hard to hear over all the shushing. You people ought to be ashamed.
Shut
Some
up.
Of us actually give a hoot about Commerce 335.
Tune in to Ready, Steady, Learn as a motley crew of academics from the University of Auckland take us through a range of thought-provoking topics. Every Tuesday on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to the University of Auckland.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
For this week's chat with the co-leader of the Green Party, Amelia spoke to James Shaw about this week's report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which shows we only have a small window remaining to avoid the planet warming 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, and how the party thinks our progression on emissions reduction has gone. Here's their chat now.
So I just wanted to start with a chat about the IPCC report released this week. It is yet more confirmation that enough isn't being done to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. What were your initial thoughts on this report?
To tell you the truth, I wasn't surprised. I mean, the data has been showing us for some time that targets that countries have set for themselves don't quite yet add up to what's required. But worse than that, countries aren't actually delivering against the targets that they've set for themselves. It's confirmation of a trend. Having said that, there was some good news in there, and that it said that we do still have now a very narrow window of time to turn it around.
In New Zealand's case, our methane emissions are still a really big problem, accounting for 44% of our emissions. What do you think of the progress the government has made in curbing these agricultural emissions?
Well, we are one of the first countries in the world to enter into any sort of agreement with its agricultural sector to reduce animal methane. But progress has been painfully slow, and we still don't have a system in place. And the proposals that I've seen are, I frankly don't think that they go far enough. So that is something that we really do need to knuckle down and deal with.
After last week's cutting of climate policies by Chris Hipkins, have you been able to chat with him about how to make up for these lost policies so that we can hit our 2025 emissions target?
Not yet, but that's frankly only a function of time rather than intent. Obviously, everyone in government's pretty busy with cyclone recovery from Gabrielle and the floods in Auckland. And so, that's just kind of occupying a lot of our attention right now. But we are working on a package of proposals. The thing is, each of those individual policies didn't make a huge difference, but collectively they do add up. And we don't, at this very late point in time, have many easy options left. So that's going to be the rub, really, will be, we're going to have to make some tough choices.
How do you reflect on your cooperation agreement with Labor over the past 3 years? Do you think you've gotten a good deal out of it? Has it been as effective as you'd have liked?
Well, over the course of 5.5 years, remember, we've been in government for two terms with them now. We've got a very good, constructive working relationship with them. We don't agree on everything, as has been evident over the course of the last week. But if we did, then we'd just be in the same political party, right? So you're always going to have moments of tension where different political parties take different views on things in government. Having said that, it is a source of some frustration to me that when you've only got two ministers and they're both outside cabinet, it does mean that you don't get to be around the cabinet table for some of the most crucial decisions. I made the argument over the weekend that with more Green MPs in Parliament and more Green ministers sitting around the cabinet table, we'll be able to ensure that the next government really prioritises action on climate change.
Yeah, and just talking about over the weekend, you had your State of the Planet address. You said that any political party that wants to negotiate with the Green Party after the election must come to the table with stronger, bolder climate action. Does this include the National Party? Would you be willing to work with them?
Well, I always get a little frustrated about this question because no one ever asks the ACT Party whether they're willing to work with the Labor Party. Like I said, we've had a very good, constructive working relationship with Labor over the course of the last 5 years, and we're far more aligned on climate change than we are with any other political party in Parliament. And so, you know, I think given the choice, why would we ever consider going with the National Party? It sort of doesn't make sense to me.
So really your only option is the Labor Party, who have kind of shown that climate policy isn't their idea of bread and butter issues. How can you convince voters that, you know, voting for the Greens would result in meaningful climate action?
Well, the whole point is that the more Green MPs you have in Parliament and the more Green ministers you have around the Cabinet table, the more influence you're able to exert over the direction of the next government. The Green Party is the party that has always prioritised action on climate change above all else. And so, you know, I think if people want a government that's committed to action on climate change, you have to ensure that the Greens have a strong hand in the next government.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
Last night's congestion in the city centre held up vehicle traffic, delaying buses for up to an hour. This morning, a number of organisations paid for an advert across the Herald promoting cycling. I talked to big street bikers Cleve Cameron about how enabling cycling in the city might unclog the streets so everyone can get around quickly, cheaply and efficiently.
I don't know whether you got stuck in the congestion in the city centre yesterday. Maybe
no,
you
I rode,
didn't.
I rode straight past it. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I rode very casually straight past all the cars. That's life on the bike lane.
Oh my goodness, people would have been looking at you with so much envy, I think, yesterday.
And yesterday morning and probably tomorrow morning as well. But I'm not alone. There's plenty of people who are starting to do it, eh?
Yeah, I think
and
so.
It's all around the world.
So on your select journey home, was it on the cycle lane? Was it on the pavement, like Wayne Brown? Or was it...
All of the above. I just try to find the safest way and try to ride where the cars aren't. And so if that means going on the pavement, then yes. Yeah, I'm taking back streets. I'm trying to take the safe back streets, cycle lanes. Yeah, the cars are the scariest thing. Some kind of macho thing that kicks in when people are in cars and they don't see other humans.
Yeah, a connected cycle network is definitely a barrier to cycling, particularly for those who are not of the super brave disposition. But tell me about Lockie Docks and the other barrier to cycling in the city.
Bike theft is a massive thing here in the city and around the country. One in three people who have their bike stolen never ride again. They stop doing it. So we know it's a really important thing. My family, we've had 60 bikes stolen ourselves in the last couple of years. Son going to work, my wife going to work, myself going to work. It just puts people back in the car. So, yeah, theft is a major issue in terms of people switching to e-bikes because we know people love e-bikes. As soon as they're on them, they want to ride. Yeah, it's just awarded the most secure bike parking in the world recently, and it provides free charging as well for people.
So a Lockie Dock is a secure bike park with free charging. And what does it cost to use them?
So it's free for the bikers to use, and it's also no cost to the property owner or ratepayers or council as well. So an easy win, a quick win. There's secure parking, people will ride more often. The other great thing with the Lockie Docks is they have a digital screen on there that has maps that show where all the safe bike paths are and show people where safe back streets. So we know there's just a really low awareness of all the safe cycleways. So it does a really important job there. And it has advertising on it, which helps pay for it and make it free to the public.
What do you see as the role of bikes in the city in the future? How do you feel Lockie Docks might fit into it?
Yeah, I just think Auckland, Tamaki Makaurau could be a fantastic biking city, especially now with e-bikes. I just so point to London. They just this week announced that there's more cyclists on their roads than there are motorists. They've had this exponential growth, and that's put in safe bike lanes. We just need to get on with it and turn into a 21st century city. So, yeah, it's a really exciting time for us if we can just jump on it now. So over 100 kilometres of cycleways into Wellington, and they realise that that's going to be the cheapest way for people to get around because petrol prices are just going to go up.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it, that cyclists are often sort of like considered this privileged group, and yet biking is actually the cheapest... outside of walking, to get around.
Yeah, it's the egalitarian transport. It's the people's vehicle. So, yeah, no, the story's sort of got away and it's been sort of curved by God knows who. The bikes are everybody's way of getting around. It's just like, it's just a transport mode and it's apolitical.
You can fit a lot of people on the road on a bike. Worked in Beijing for many a year.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So what about this Herald ad that's getting a bit of Twitter attention?
Good. Oh, that's good. Taken over the front cover of the Herald. Yeah. with a number of other brands, businesses, Mana Whenua, so Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei on there as well. Just showing these are all the groups that are behind biking. It's not some crazy fringe thing. It's just actually these are loved brands and businesses and organisations that support biking because it's just what people do.
I know that the council is looking for really, really big budget cuts, and you can't help thinking that making it easier to cycle is the cheapest way.
Yeah, the cheapest way
to get Auckland moving without big gold-plated infrastructure, you know, digging projects. So
it's a really important time. There's submissions to the council are due on the 28th of March on those budget cuts. Auckland Have Your Say, or AKL Have Your Say, the site. So encourage everybody to go there and make sure that they're having their say. Yeah, we've put in some suggestions. It's on our website, bigstreetbikers.co.nz. Seeing Chloe Swarbrick has done some fantastic suggestions as well. So you can go through her socials. We'll have a link to it as well.
And what are the next steps for you? Do you have any Lucky Dock sites already in Auckland?
We've got, I think there's 10 or 13, there's 13 in Auckland. We're rolling out 100 Lucky Docks over this year. There'll be a fair number of those going to Auckland, central and out west and down south.
And how can you find out where they are?
So there's app, so you can download the app. So lockerdock.co.nz, and that tells you where all docks are. AT also have it on their apps as well, shows where the Lockie docks are.
So that was Big Street Bikers Cleve Cameron talking about Lockie docks and enabling cycling.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11pm, only on 95BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. The Auckland Council and Immigration New Zealand are allowing anti-trans campaigner Kelly Jane Keane Mitchell, aka Posey Parker, to enter Aotearoa and hold a transphobic event in Tamaki Makaurau this weekend. I spoke to Ahi Wihongi, National Coordinator at Gender Minorities Aotearoa, about why Posey Parker entering Aotearoa is a danger to trans people. Why is Posey Parker entering Aotearoa a danger to trans people?
I think that the interesting thing about Posey Parker is that she isn't someone who simply pretends to be a feminist. She's stated very openly that she is not a feminist. She is someone who is very closely aligned with neo-Nazis. She's appeared on shows alongside the Proud Boys and has documented links to the Proud Boys, which is a fascist group in the USA, and they are classified as terrorist group in New Zealand. And I think that she's here to promote more than just anti-trans sentiment.
National and ACT MPs in particular have defended these events and Parker coming into the country, stating that we need to protect freedom of speech. What do you think about this argument?
My question would be, how are we protecting the freedom of speech of things like drag story time, which are being shut down by these far-right groups? We've had armed neo-Nazis show up at drag story time in Ohio in the US and shut that down, and now it's starting to happen here. There's a group in Christchurch which is very much aligned with that, who've been trying to shut down drag story time there. We've seen drag story time being attacked in Auckland and down south. How is the freedom of speech of these people being protected in comparison with these neo-Nazi groups and, far-right anti-trans campaigners who are trying to claim freedom of speech?
Aotearoa has seen an increase in sort of far-right and anti-LGBTQIA plus movements, particularly after COVID-19. So what would your personal calls be for Aotearoa to better protect vulnerable communities targeted by hate groups?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. it's really important for people to understand that at the moment in the US, these, like Posy Parker herself and also similar anti-trans campaigners, together with neo-Nazis who show up, you know, waving swastikas and things, at the moment there are armed gangs of neo-Nazis in the US hunting trans people, and there are also laws at the moment. They're trying to pass laws to completely ban drag in Ohio with a view to eventually completely banning trans people. We don't want to go back in history and see the, you know, like in Nazi Germany, they were using the public nuisance laws to stop trans people. We don't want to return to fascism. Fascism isn't something we want for this country, and there's a very close alignment between these groups, not just an ideological alignment, but like literally links between these anti-trans campaigners and neo-Nazism and fascism. And I think it's really important to understand that what they have in common, and including the very far-right fundamentalist religious groups, what they all have in common is that they is gender essentialism. They want women back in the kitchen. They don't want reproductive rights. Posy Parker has campaigned against abortion rights. It's all connected. All those groups there, you know, they are trying to enforce gender essentialism, and I don't think that we want that for New Zealand.
Thank you for that. And I guess what do you think then, the sort of lack of action about protecting vulnerable communities and allowing people like Posy Parker to speak, says about how the LGBTQIA plus community is treated here in Aotearoa?
I would like to think that it's naivety on the part of those politicians who are not taking this seriously. I would like to think it's naivety rather than an alignment of values. Fingers crossed.
Did this decision and sort of politicians and I guess the council and Immigration New Zealand's sort of downplaying of this, did this surprise you at all?
Well, Posy Parker is a UK citizen and we are a colony, so it's not surprising that she is able to come here. But given her well-documented links to the Proud Boys and the fact that they are, the Proud Boys is classified as a terrorist organisation in New Zealand, we thought that there might be, you know, we hoped that it might be taken a bit more seriously. I'm sure that they have their processes that they go through when they're deciding these things. So, no, not surprised.
How has the, I guess you could just comment on the people that you're around, how has the trans community and its allies responded to this event going forward?
Yeah, I think that people are worried. People have some really genuine fears for fears of violence because we have seen, you know, we have seen so much violence at the hands of these sort of pro, you know, these neo-Nazi, white supremacist, anti-trans sort of conglomerations. I think people are very afraid and people are angry and they don't want this sort of thing becoming normal in New Zealand. We have seen what that looks like overseas in the UK and the US. Like, we see what that looks like, and there's so, you know, literally armed fascist gangs hunting trans people. People are really scared that that's going to be what ends up happening here. And the other thing that people are scared about is that the other side of how this is done, of how they achieve that sort of anti-trans climate, is legislating against us. And, you know, that in Ohio, obviously the people in Parliament, in politics, are trying to push through banning trans people, banning drag. People are concerned that that will happen here. And if politicians here do have interests aligned with those fascist and anti-trans campaigners, you know, I think that that's something that actually everybody should be quite concerned about.
What would your advice be for people if they want to condemn this decision and or show their support for trans people in the wider rainbow community? What can people do to have their voice heard?
Overall, I think it's much more important to have a strong show of support for trans people, and to do that in your everyday life, and to do that in our workplaces and in our schools and, you know, in our society, that's the really important work that needs doing. If everybody understands trans people as part of the community who deserve the same human rights and the same care and respect and right to live and be who they are, yeah, like the best thing people can do is also, besides just that stuff, it's understanding the issues. And I think that's one of the very difficult things. It's quite hard to explain it, and it's quite hard to understand all the different political parts of how all of those groups that seem quite separate, you wouldn't think people who might call themselves feminists would be aligned with neo-Nazis and white supremacists. And so it's quite complex to understand how that all fits together.
Thank you so much for that. And that was all the questions that I had, unless there was anything else you wanted our listeners to know.
Actually, it's just that it's hard not to get really upset when you're talking about this stuff.
Because yeah.
Such a huge threat, and it's such a lot for people to get their heads around, you know, how that works with laws and politics, and it's scary that people, you know, we know that trans people have been assaulted at anti-trans campaign sort of events in New Zealand, and you know, there's a threat of immediate violence, and we worry a lot about that threat, especially against young people who will show up to counter-protest, and they will show up, they'll show up to try and demand that they have a right to exist. You know, they show up to assert that they've got a right to exist. And then you've got professional campaigners, international professional campaigners, who are there to incite violence against those people. So it's quite an unfair ground. They're not standing on equal grounding. And so we have a lot of fears, we have a lot of concerns for like the safety, especially of young trans people who are protesting, as well as just more broadly.
And that was Ahiwi Hongi, National Coordinator at Gender Minorities, about why Posey Parker entering Aotearoa is a danger to trans people.
The Wire.
But there's some real fascists out here.
Collaborators at several universities are testing a new faith-based smoking cessation method around the tradition of Ramadan and Muslim culture. Studies show Muslim men have high smoking rates, and this study seeks to implement a cessation method for the next Ramadan. I spoke to Abdullah Della Kalantan, doctoral researcher at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Medical and Health Sciences, to find out more about this project. I started by asking what the role of religion was in quitting smoking. What is the role of religion in quitting smoking?
So religion is supposed to be a motivator for whoever follows their religion to quit smoking. And in Islam, smoking is forbidden. According to many countries that declared smoking as a prohibited behavior. But still, there are some Muslims who believe that smoking is only discouraged. And that may be the reason why they're still smoking. So the role of religion supposedly is to prevent and encourage Muslims from smoking.
What does phase one of your study involve?
So phase one involves the qualitative interviews. So we are interviewing Muslims who are above 18 years old and who used to smoke or are current smoker of cigarettes and shisha, which is water pipe smoking. So we want to know and explore the reasons why they smoke and the challenges they face when they quit smoking. And we want to know their views on the role of faith in quitting smoking and in their smoking behavior from their perspective, of course. And then lastly, we want to know their views and opinions about developing and delivering a faith-based smoking cessation intervention during the month of Ramadan.
What does phase two of your study involve?
Phase two involves developing the intervention with religious leaders and then So the intervention will be informed by the results from the qualitative study and also informed by feedback and comments from religious leaders. So the role of religious leaders is actually to give us feedback on the religious messages, which are going to be informed by the Quran or the Sunnah, which is the Prophet's speech. So the Quran and Sunnah will have messages to Muslims that encourage them to stop smoking. Also with the religious messages, there's going to be health messages. So we want to religious leaders to just check if our use of religious messages is appropriate or not. And then developing the intervention, which will be trialed in a feasibility or a pilot study during Ramadan, next Ramadan, 2024.
Why did you pick Ramadan as a time to test this faith-based cessation method?
So from previous studies, we found that Ramadan is an opportunistic period for many Muslims to quit smoking. So there are multiple studies that showed Muslims' willingness to quit or reduce smoking during Ramadan. And one big reason is the spiritual, you could say, spiritual environment that Ramadan brings. And Muslims try to be good Muslims during that month. They want to increase their worship. They want to get rid of bad habits. But also, there is a spontaneous reduction of tobacco consumption during Ramadan because during the daylight hours, they are not allowed to smoke. So there is a spontaneous reduction. And so implementing the intervention in Ramadan, we assume that it will help them reduce or quit smoking. And so our, like you could say, the intervention is to help Muslim smokers reduce or quit smoking during the nighttime.
Now, I saw you were working with some other universities. What schools are those?
So other universities is the University of Umm al-Qura or Umm al-Qura University in Saudi Arabia, in Mecca. And I have a co-supervisor there. And also University of Malaya in Malaysia, and I also have a co-supervisor there. So actually this study is carried out in two countries, New Zealand and Saudi Arabia. So we have done phase one in Saudi Arabia already. We have interviewed Muslim smokers and ex-smokers, and we've conducted a workshop with religious leaders through which we developed a library of messages, the text messages, that we want, that is the component, the main component of the intervention. And we're going to do the same in New Zealand. So initially we wanted to do that in Malaysia as well, but we thought that was too ambitious and we might not have enough time and resources to do three countries.
Were there any interesting results from the study in Saudi Arabia that jump out at you?
Yes. So from the qualitative study, there is an indication, or you could say an preliminary evidence, that many smokers still smoke or started smoking because of peer pressure, and because smoking is normalized in many societies in Saudi Arabia, so that's how they started or initiated smoking and still smoke. Gathering with friends is a main reason to smoke and continue smoking. But also there are factors like the price of tobacco is very affordable in Saudi Arabia, although they increase the taxes on tobacco products, but many still find it cheap and affordable. And then other reasons include stress and family issues in Saudi Arabia. But of course, we can't generalize these results. It's an indication.
That was Abdullah Dilla Kalan on a new project to help Muslim smoking cessation.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
In the pursuit of meeting emissions reduction targets, the transition to electric vehicles is seeming like a bit of a necessity. With battery range and charging stations a worry for EV owners, the government and research organisations from around the world are banding together to come up with new solutions to instill confidence in EV fleets. I had a little chat with Doug Wilson, director of the Transportation Research Centre at the University of Auckland. His research facility is designing and testing the possibilities of wireless charging roads in Aotearoa to remedy range anxiety for EV owners. The partnership between Downer and the University of Auckland has been tasked with testing the resilience and application of this technology on our roads. I started off by asking Doug about what this technology is and how it works.
Could you just explain a little bit about what wireless charging roads are and how the technology is intended to work?
Yeah, and that's a great question. The wireless technologies has been around for almost 3 decades now, and you can see that in evidence of the wireless phone, where you've got you can charge basically, or your toothbrush, where you can connect it together. And so in transport, that's been a relatively new innovation in regards to the last 10 years, where we're wanting to charge over a gap between a pad and the roadway, and then a vehicle passing over that. So the technology can be in a stationary situation, so you could have it over a car park where you park your car over it and aligns basically, and you charge from a primary pad in the roadway to a secondary pad that is coupled from your vehicle. So it also can be used while it's moving, so what we call semi-dynamic charging, where you can think about a taxi rank at an airport or a bus bay where buses are coming in, etc. And so you don't need to plug in conductively to charge that battery, which moves a whole lot of infrastructure and a whole lot of inconvenience for the users. And then the final sort of version of EV charging with wireless charging is actually what we call fully dynamic, and that it would be on a lane on a motorway, for example, and you are travelling at 100, 110 kilometres an hour, whatever, and you're in that lane, and if you've got the technology in your vehicle, you will then be able to charge in nanoseconds as it couples from one pad to the next.
Would this technology be able to be retrofitted to existing electric vehicles, or would this be reliant on electric vehicle producers to implement this technology in their vehicles in the future?
I mean, the most economic way to do this is to have basically it in the vehicle technologies, all right. So the newer models of vehicles are basically there is already a vehicle standard that is across all OEMs, the original equipment manufacturers for vehicles. So they can now basically put the secondary coupler on their vehicle, which you can purchase as a sort of, it's still quite new in the sense it's taken 10 years to get that standardisation across the line, but that is coming out in potentially new vehicles now. The retrofitting to a existing vehicle is a much more difficult because you have to change quite a lot to that vehicle. And some vehicles that would be extremely difficult, other vehicles a bit easier to do. And so there's not a lot of, some manufacturers of the pads are looking at that as a consideration, but that is quite an expensive upgrade to an existing vehicle.
Following on from this, the government's aiming to, meet emissions reduction targets, and electrifying New Zealand's roads is seems like the key to that, to by increasing the EV fleets that all of us are driving. Do you think that implementing this technology within Aotearoa would minimise the cost of EVs by any chance?
The government has a strategy, three-pronged strategy, to avoid emissions, shift emissions to more sort of sustainable or more shared modes, and to then improve the vehicle fleets with emissions. So this wireless technology is only really addresses the improving the vehicle fleet emissions in the sense that, if you've got a vehicle and you're going to use it, whether it's a private motor vehicle or a commercial vehicle or a bus, for example, you basically can remove the emissions from those types of vehicles. So yes, and it's an existing technology, so it's not waiting for something in the future to happen. It makes a lot of sense to target basically improving our vehicle fleet, given that our EV fleet at the moment is just over 1%, to help remove the constraints for people and the nervousness that people have to go towards EVs, this wireless technologies, really does enable people to have a much better user experience, just like we have with our smartphones, etc. It just perfectly aligns. You don't have to worry about it, right?
So how long do you think it would take for those technologies to be implemented within the roads in the future?
Certainly the stationary pads, I mean, they can be rolled out as of next year. And in fact, you know, there's companies like Witricity in Boston who we are collaborating with are very, very keen supporters of our research. They have solutions now that are called sort of blister pads, which stick above a part garage floor, for example, or in a parking building that you can purchase and put in. We're looking at in-ground solutions because we think the blister pad sticking above is not going to be, obviously, once you get out into a public roadway, that's not going to serve the other requirements that we need. And so we're looking at either surface-mounted pads or buried into the surface where you don't even see them at all, so they could be below the asphalt, and that's what's going to need to be in a sort of more high-speed environment situation. So, the solutions for stationary pads are much more available. They will be rolled out quicker. The fully dynamic situations to be able to meet all of the requirements for high-speed alignments, and also the power generation that's going to need to be getting to those positions and where we place those in terms of modelling. So we do a lot of also EV adoption, micro-simulation modelling of where traffic is going, where does it make sense to optimise where you would have these, because you wouldn't put it into every single road in the country. There would only be areas where you would optimise for these charging systems.
It's interesting you mentioned providing electricity to these different charging stations. Do you think that more resilience would need to be built within Aotearoa's electricity infrastructure to fuel or to electrify this, or to make it a possibility?
Yeah, well, I'm obviously from New Zealand. Aotearoa, it makes sense for us to improve, electrify our fleet as quickly as possible, because we already have greater than 80% renewable energy in our generation of energy. A lot of other countries are much, much lower in proportions on that, which means they're still producing, obviously, emissions at their point of source where they create the energy. We are not, most of our renewable energy is hydro, but the key thing is, as we now provide a whole new use for energy, we do need to have a lot more resilience in our energy network.
That was Doug Wilson talking to me about the work the Transportation Research Centre at the University of Auckland is doing in designing wireless charging roads of tomorrow. Doug emailed me shortly after the interview to share the idea of power snacking. The implementation of wireless charging in roads removes the need for large and heavy batteries to travel distances, meaning a lighter vehicle that uses less rare earth materials and is thus more affordable for consumers.
But in terms of comparing it to the current prison system, though, would you say that it could be an improvement?
I mean, no, how do you improve a piece of shit?
The Wire.
Scientists have been calling for a ban on light polluting mass satellite groups like Elon Musk's Starlink for some time now. Scientists are concerned that the light pollution from these so-called mega constellations make it difficult to view objects in space. I spoke to University of Auckland astrophysicist Professor Richard Easter to find out more about artificial light pollution from satellites. Mega constellations have more than doubled the number of functional satellites in low Earth orbit since early 2019. What is a satellite mega constellation?
So a satellite mega constellation is a system where, instead of just having, you know, one or two satellites doing a job, you have literally hundreds or sometimes thousands or tens of thousands of satellites that are in a low orbit, so there's only a few of them overhead at any time. And they provide things like communication services or environmental monitoring, or, you know, a variety of use cases.
What issues does Starlink, a mega constellation, pose for astronomers and those studying space and the skies?
So the problem with Starlink in particular is that Starlink is the biggest mega constellation that's currently being deployed. And secondly, that a lot of the Starlink satellites are relatively bright in the sky. So both just with the naked eye, you can in many cases see the Starlink satellites at night, but also the the satellites move, and so they show up in astronomical images, even if they're too faint to be easily seen with the naked eye.
What other sources of artificial light at night make studying space difficult?
You know, anything that's produced by human beings, essentially, you know, that escapes into the night sky is going to make it more difficult to see the stars. So we have something called sky glow, where artificial light is, lights up the atmosphere, essentially. So, you know, if you're, you know, driving to Auckland, you know, from along State Highway 1, you can kind of see the glow in the sky before you arrive at the city. And that glow, you know, makes it harder to perform, you know, precise measurements of objects in the sky. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why big astronomical observatories are located, you know, far from sources of artificial light.
Is there a risk that large observatories wouldn't be able to function anymore with this increased artificial light at night?
The artificial light, maybe less so if the observatories are very remote. But I think the bigger risk in the short term is from, you know, unmanaged deployment of large constellations of satellites. And in particular with Starlink and a couple of others, you know, it's essentially unregulated. And there's been something of a land grab. You know, once you've deployed a constellation, then it's going to be harder to change the way that it's configured for regulators. And so I think there has been an effort to get satellites in place as quickly as possible to sort of stake out a slice of the space around the Earth, simply, you know, to make it harder, you know, to subsequently regulate those things in ways that would, you know, crimp their operations.
In your view, do we already have too many satellites in space in low Earth orbit?
That's a tricky one. I think we have to be really aware that things like Starlink, I mean, actually have a real utility. They're not being, you know, put there for amusement. You know, so we saw with the recent floods, for instance, you know, Starlink terminals, which are now, you know, widely deployed in New Zealand. A lot of remote farms will have them. And, you know, they do give really good access to the internet, which is, you know, a necessity of daily life. So, you know, communications after disasters, you know, helping people in remote areas, you know, fully participate in society. You know, Starlink serves a really useful purpose. And I think the challenge is to figure out, you know, how to deliver that benefit in ways that don't, you know, make a mess for other people. And it's certainly been the case up until now that there hasn't, you know, there is actually tight restrictions on what you put into orbit. And it's a process to get approval for, you know, even for the smaller satellite, something we've dealt with here at the University of Auckland. But it's also clear that the processes that we've got are sort of imagining, you know, one or two satellites at a time, and they haven't scaled well to something the size of Starlink.
Is it possible to retain Starlink and other satellites while improving night star viewing conditions?
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, one of the things we've seen actually is that originally Starlink, oh, you know, was, I think there were some very naive comments, you know, from Starlink and from Elon Musk in particular, saying, oh, you know, you can just do astronomy from space. And the reality is that, you know, the world's biggest telescopes are easier to build on the ground. And so, you know, we're super excited about the James Webb Space Telescope, but at the same time, we're building, you know, much bigger ground-based telescopes. And so it is possible to engineer satellites like Starlink so that they're less obtrusive. And that's obviously going to cost, you know, some money and effort that you wouldn't otherwise expend. And so part of it is making sure that, you know, whatever mitigations are in place have been applied, you know, as thoroughly as possible.
Do you think government regulation is necessary to ensure those design improvements and to improve the viewing of the night sky?
I think it's clear that there already is really intense government regulation around the use of space. So, you know, there are agreements between countries about, you know, what circumstances things can launch, you know, who's responsible if, you know, if an object comes back to Earth and causes damage. You know, this is an area of intense, you know, legal and legislative activity. And so it's not, you know, wouldn't be something new to regulate space, but it's certainly true that the current management of the constellations, the processes we have, simply haven't kept up, and they need to be adapted quickly to address these issues.
Finally, how do decommissioned satellites get removed from space to minimize space junk?
So that's actually an interesting one. Little ones, you can just rely on them burning up in the atmosphere. Somewhat bigger ones, there's a tendency now to either move them into parking orbits so that they'll be up for a very long time. Or alternatively, they have kind of things called drag sails, you know, little kind of balloons that inflate, you know, as they're to increase the drag that they experience to quickly remove them from orbit. But actually, it's a huge problem. And it is expected that people who put large objects in space will have a plan to bring them out of orbit. I mean, and it's, you know, particularly challenging if the satellite fails, you know, and therefore isn't, you know, responsive to commands from the ground. And dealing with that problem is actually a, you know, ongoing technical challenge and a lot of activity in that area, including here in New Zealand.
That was Professor Richard Easter, astrophysicist at the University of Auckland, on the light pollution caused by Starlink and other satellite constellations.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēne wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēne rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Wednesday. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, AUSA President Alan Shaker, Green Party co-leader James Shaw, Cleve Cameron from Big City Street Bikers, Ahi Wehongi, National Coordinator of Gender Minorities of Aotearoa, Abdullah Dela Kalantan, doctoral researcher at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Medical and Health Sciences, Doug Wilson, director of the Transportation Research Centre at the University of Auckland, and University of Auckland astrophysicist Professor Richard Easter. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.